Welcome to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. Behavior Analysis in Practice is a podcast committed to narrowing the research practice gap and demystifying the research process. Each episode will take a deep dive into the latest work published in Behavior Analysis in Practice, the journal, by interviewing the paper's author about the topic. We'll explore the nuances of each paper and ask the questions you wish you could ask the authors after reading the paper. Hello and welcome back to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast. I'm your host, Cody Morse, Assistant Professor of Behavior Analysis at Salve Regina University. And today I'm going to be speaking with Malaika Pritchett and Shala Alai Rosales about their paper titled Social Justice is the Spirit and Aim of an Applied Science of Human Behavior, Moving from Colonial to Participatory Research Practice. Malaika is an assistant professor of practice in the Department of Applied Behavioral Science at the University of Kansas, and her research interests include research ethics, human rights, community-based participatory research, youth violence prevention, and positive behavior supports. Shala is a professor in the Department of Behavior Analysis at the University of North Texas. She has served on several boards and disciplinary committees and has published and presented research on social justice, ethics in early intervention, play in social skills, family harmony, and supervision and mentoring. Together, Malaika and Shala have a lot of interesting experience that they talk about in this interview. The interview is incredibly interesting, and I'm very excited to share it with you. So without further ado, here's my interview with Malaika Pritchett and Shala Alai Rosales. Hi, Malaika and Shala. Welcome to Behavior Analysis in Practice, the podcast.
Hi, Cody.
Hi, Cody. Thanks for having us.
Of course. I'm really excited to have you here today to talk about your paper. I found it extremely interesting, and I'm excited to sort of dive into the pieces of it. But before we get into the paper, we always like to hear a little bit about the guests, to hear maybe their background in terms of sort of what led them to behavior analysis or how they got involved with the field, and maybe why they're interested in this particular research, right? So why the topic of this paper? Like, how did you get pulled into this particular subtopic in behavior analysis? And so could we start with Malaika? Would you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So my wandering into the field of behavior analysis was very much an accident and very much a product of having friends that just so happened to be studying behavior analysis at the University of North Texas. I went to undergrad originally to be a marine biologist. And my favorite part of my story with regard to higher education is that I got really excited about getting admitted to San Diego State University. I grew up in a small town just north of Dallas in Allen, Texas. There's one high school there, and I was one of the only students that was actually going to leave the state for college. So really excited to pursue marine biology. And then second semester of my senior year, just kind of did whatever I wanted, didn't really pay attention to too many of my grades. I was already admitted. I was already bragging to everybody that I was leaving for California and landed on San Diego State's campus. And they had revoked my provisional admission. As an out-of-state student, my GPA had dropped lower than when I had applied to the university, and they gave priority to students in California, and so they sent me home. And it was probably one of the most embarrassing. I didn't even have enough money for a flight back home. I got on an Amtrak and came back to Texas and walked into my local community college very late registration wise and found myself in a situation where I'd been humbled really early about the idea that higher education isn't a luxury that you can just have and you don't get to do whatever you want. You have to work really hard. And I think that was the best turning point in me understanding what it meant to really be a student and to really be a scientist and to also not walk into educational opportunities, taking them for granted. I think I was on that trajectory as an 18-year-old. And my very first semester at community college, met a professor That was a history professor that really took me under his wing and got me to be excited about learning and about the learning process. And at that point, I realized what a professor did, and it sounded like a cool job to me as an 18-year-old. So I had always known that I was going to go to graduate school, but I ended up in moving away from biology a little bit because I became an interpreter, and I had learned American Sign Language, and I began working as an interpreter. So the logical step for me was to go and get my bachelor's degree in communication sciences and disorders. And eventually, I was thinking I was going to do a master's degree either in speech language pathology or deaf education. And so when I was kind of going through that journey, I landed in some classrooms and I started doing some student teaching opportunities and saw that children that couldn't communicate well engaged in some pretty significant challenging behaviors that I had no idea how to help or what to do. So I had a little bit of a panic right after I finished my bachelor's degree because I knew I wanted to go to graduate school, but I did not in any way, shape, or form want to be a deaf educator. I didn't think that I had the training or the skills or the expertise. So I had no idea how I was going to pivot and just went and was hanging out with some friends in Denton. I went to Texas Women's University in Denton. And Texas Women's University and University of North Texas are probably maybe 7 minutes away, depending on how you drive and if you hit some lights. So these campuses are very close to each other, and Denton's a big college town that has a lot of students that are in lots of different places and doing lots of really interesting things. And just walked into a barbecue one day, really upset, didn't know what I was going to do with my life, having another set of crises with regard to education. And I really didn't want to work in the real world. I didn't feel like getting a full-time job and doing all of that. And a friend of a friend ended up, or no, a good friend of mine, Donnie Staff, ended up saying, "Have you heard about behavior analysis? I'm at the University of North Texas. You should just come by tomorrow and see what we do." And the rest is really history. I put all of my eggs in one basket. I only applied to North Texas master's program in behavior analysis. I was admitted. The other side of the story that I was telling Shala about once I was admitted was nobody told me how rigorous this criteria was to get into this program. I just applied because a friend of mine at a barbecue told me it was a good idea. And then, of course, landed in one of the most prestigious and historically relevant master's programs in our field. And so that is how my journey started. When I intersected with Shala, I intersected with Shala in her autism lab. And one of the thought processes and one of the loves that I have is just investigating permanent products. I'm really interested in permanent products and behavior analysis. And I'm really interested clinically in doing case report reviews and looking through lots of different measures of progress. And I love looking through journal articles and understanding the historical context and lines of research and where they originate from and where they lead to and in the future where they're going. And so that started a journey that Shal and I have been on for a while now, almost 20 years now, throughout my master's and doctorate level training. So that's the kind of a long, short answer to that to get us going.
Well, it's inspiring to hear about that sort of bump in the road when you started college and how you ultimately bounced back and found your way to behavior analysis. I always love, no one's path to behavior analysis is really very traditional, is what I'm learning by always asking this question on the podcast. It's always so cool to hear about how people seem to fumble their way to this field. It's pretty interesting. Shala, would you mind giving
Yeah.
a little bit?
Yeah, I have to say, as Malika said, we've been colleagues and friends and partners and in lots of important work for almost 20 years. I always gauge it by our children's ages and what was happening in terms of all of that. But I have to say too, every time you tell your story, Malika, I find something else to admire about you. In terms of the way you look at the world and in terms of how you're framing and understanding your own development and process, it's very nice. I actually, there's so many ways to tell an origin story. And I think because of the paper we're looking at today, because of of this wonderful collaboration Malaika and I have had for a long time. I'm going to start the year before I was born. I will not cover all the history because I'm old, but I do want to start in 1959. The UN made this declaration about the rights of the child. That was a year before I was born. And honestly, I feel like that was sort of a marker for me. And a North Star for me, actually, that's a better way to put it, that throughout my life, there has been something that has been very important about looking at the lives of children and looking at the human rights of children and looking at how we can create societies that advance and help each child become the light of the world, which they can be if they have the right environments. And that's the segue to the next thing. I'll move up to high school. I read Walden too. And I was also volunteering in a Head
Start program. In high school,
program.
You read Walden too?
I read Walden too in high school. And Cows, Pigs, Wars, and Witches. I don't know if you know what that book is, but it's a book by Marvin Harris, who is a cultural anthropologist. But I read both of those books in high school. And I also had parents, like Malaika's parents and grandparents, who were very involved in the civil rights movement, who were very involved in human rights. Human rights advocacy globally. Anyway, so that's part of the reason I was probably interested in those books, but I also was getting into trouble. And my parents had a friend who ran a community action agency, a Head Start program, Miss Juliette Whitaker, who was phenomenal. And I didn't understand at the time, but part of what she was incorporating in her program, it was during the project follow through years and the behavior analysis model. So there was some direct instruction and there was some conscious organization of the early childhood and family environment. So from those kinds of things, I ended up at Southern Illinois University, and I guess, like Malaika said, the rest is sort of history. I was so fortunate to have John and Sandra Lutzker as my mentors, and I really think a lot of the labor that Malaika and I have done in this area. Malaika was also did an internship in Atlanta with Dr. Lutzker for his program Project Safe Care, but. His approach to applied behavior analysis has influenced us, as had after SIU, I went to University of Kansas, where Malaika is now. It's like this lovely circle, and was very heavily influenced in many different ways by Jim Sherman, Jan Sheldon, Barbara Edsel, Don Baer, Todd Risley, Mott Wolf. So the applied behavior analysis that came out of that revolutionary period of the 60s and 70s was sort of ingrained in how we learned to approach practice and research. So, and then I came to UNT and Malaika and I started working together, as she said, in an autism program we had that was specifically designed to serve under-resourced and marginalized families. So from the very beginning, that was our goal, but we had a lot of work and understanding to do. And Malaika was a really important part of looking at some of those permanent products that allowed us a better picture of who we were serving, who we were, and how we were serving them. And if we were meeting our goals of not only serving under-resourced families, but also serving them with dignity, respect, and progress. It was important to us to also be very effective. So that was, she was part of this, I think of them now as like the, you know, the Avengers, the Marvel characters. I think we need a better name than Avengers, but it was this just phenomenal group of young, smart people with a lot of energy and a lot of strong values about how science can make the world a better place. So it was just this really lovely period, and we all learned a lot during it. And I think the fruits of Malaika's labor with this dissertation, which has actually been published in a couple of pieces, are a result of her own beautiful history and her grandparents' parents' history, but also from that period where there were so many of us really focused in a particular way.
And I think the common thread that's really important that links Shala and I really intensely, that maybe doesn't link other behavior analysts as intensely, is we're constantly reflecting on our family and we're constantly reflecting on the generations before us. It's sometimes generations that we've never met before, especially being people of color and people that have parents that immigrated to the United States and being in lots of different spaces and places and times as far as our identity is concerned and over time as we mature in age. But the common thread is human rights. And Shally, your parents were married on World Human Rights Day. Is that what it was?
United Nations Day.
United Nations
they
Day.
They picked that day. Well, you have a good memory. They picked that day specifically because that was part of why they were married. Like they even saw their union between cultures as part of the effort to make the world more inclusive.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
awesome.
My grandparents, it is cool. And my maternal grandparents served in the United Nations in various capacities. And my grandfather was an economist representing the country of Sudan. And then my grandmother represented the country of Scotland and was a physician and was really interested in making sure that women in a North Africa, Northeast Africa area had access to reproductive needs or to have their reproductive needs met and to have those rights upheld with regard to how many children they wanted to have and under what conditions and so on. So these are the underlying assumptions that Shal and I never differ from. Now we don't agree all of the time. That would be silly for a team of scientists and researchers and me being the mentee over all of these years to constantly agree, but there always is a foundational understanding that we don't shake from, which really helps guide these conversations, I think.
I think that's a really important point, is that agreement or disagreement is not, it's almost not part of the dialogue for us. It's having some strong common values and understanding that everybody has different perspectives and not even to see them as disagreements, as, oh, this is one perspective that starts to help us form the whole picture. Mm-hmm. And that even if the two perspectives appear to be in conflict, you can learn something from that and find a bigger truth. Or a more relevant measure or a way forward or whatever it is. So we almost invited very intense different perspectives, both between ourselves and in the groups that we've been working with. But if you don't have the common values and agreement about that, that becomes contention and political, you know, and that's where it gets really hard, is without the value piece. But
that makes a lot of sense. Thank you both for sharing that background and how you were sort of found your way to behavior analysis, how you connected to each other, how you work with each other. I think a lot of the context you provided in those stories really lends itself to understanding this paper, really, and the purpose of this paper. And you said early in the paper, you said part of the purpose of the paper was to examine practices of our applied science to suggest ways to move forward in setting up research scenarios and agendas to address and challenge systematic injustices. And within that section, you sort of talked a lot about sort of big picture societal issues. How is it that you see the science of behavior analysis as a potential tool to take on some of these big picture societal issues and systematic injustices, all those things? How does our science of behavior analysis relate to taking on these things?
That's a difficult question, Cody. I would like to be specific about the fact that I think that's in the wheelhouse of applied behavior analysis. I don't think that we can really have conversations about injustices and people suffering and people's lives not improving without specifically orienting towards applied behavior analysis and what it really means to be an applied science. And Shal and I have these ongoing conversations with each other about what it means to be applied and about the origin of research questions and the origin of ideas for how to make sure that these questions are answered and the way in which the research engagement happens in a way that's participatory and the people, ideally, the people bringing the concern to the table are the ones that are empowered to continue to have agency over their lives or continue to understand how their communities work and the importance and the interactions of the people within those communities without this oppressive scientist landing in this area, taking over everything, telling everybody what to do, and then disappearing. So the science of applied behavior analysis is extremely powerful and can do things that we probably can't imagine. I think one of the things that I'd have pause about is the way in which those activities are executed and the competing reinforcers potentially from the participants and the researchers, and those reinforcers maybe not aligning.
I think I'd like to say also, in addition to the values about human rights and the values about the dignity and worth of every being on the planet, we also share another value, and that is about science. It's about the beauty, the power, and the importance of science. And in particular for us, it's applied behavior analysis. I could say we love applied behavior analysis. And we also understand that there is so much more to learn, that science is a progressive thing, not only in terms of the findings of science, but also in terms of the methods and the way that scientific practice evolves. So I agree 100% with Malaika that, you know, there's a lot we don't know about how it's going to evolve. But we do know that, like all sciences, you know, it has the potential to help us understand the patterns and the mechanisms of our behavior and of our behavior with one another and our behavior across different species, all of it. It has the potential for us to understand that and also to be able to change and modify, improve behavior in ways that have wonderful outcomes that are agreed upon, but also in ways that everybody can participate in that process of how the science evolves and what kinds of outcomes we produce. I think that, you know, Bill Hewitt and colleagues published a paper recently in Perspectives in Behavior Science, which I think is a really important paper about all the different ways that we can look at this beautiful science of behavior and how it can help humanity in so many different ways, from sustainability to education to helping empower people who are more vulnerable on the planet, you know, all of that. But it is a relatively new science. It's a very new science. In the course of human evolution, like, we're just a little blip recently. So how we do that is still very much left for us to discover. And I think, you know, Malaika should speak to this, but watching Malaika in the process of figuring out, you know, what she was going to do with her dissertation, it was so important to her with the permanent products and to understand the big context of where we were in that progression of trying to move the science forward. I don't know if you want to add to that in some way, but
yeah, I was thinking two things. The first thing is, again, back from Dr. Heward's paper in Perspectives, and then understanding all of the different, walking through that article, you see all the different domains in which behavior analysis can be impactful with improving our world in a lot of different domains. Again, the United Nations is very interested in behavioral science and has put out a report about the fact that behavioral science is a critical tool. So the Secretary General at this point in time with the United Nations is saying that in no uncertain circumstances, that behavior science is really the way forward, right? We've known this for a very long time, but our times are so urgent and our times are so critical, and there's a lot of social disruption across the globe in very critical domains. So the United Nations is listing areas for opportunity areas for behavioral science: health inequities, gender, climate change, preventing violent extremism, reducing the burdens on public health administration with regard to what they call sludge. In other words, just backlogging and burdens to systems that actually don't get the health and wellness improved of the person on the other end that's in need because of all these administrative processes. So the United Nations is, I tell people a lot of times, if you're not really interested in the United Nations or you don't really know too much about human rights in the United Nations, that's okay in the past. But now moving forward, you really should be dialed in because the United Nations is very much invested in behavioral science and has been. I don't recall a time when science hasn't been the driving mechanism for life changes and for the upholding the rights of all humans from the United Nations perspective. But now I forgot the second thing I was going to say. That happens all the time. I was very passionate about the United Nations being... Oh, well, I was going to say, now I remember. I was going to say, Shala, I don't remember how this paper, my dissertation that ended up being published in two sections, the social justice paper in behavior analysis and practice, and then the other half of it in the research ethics textbook, about historical understandings about behavior analysis and human rights. But for the social justice paper and our analysis of JABA over all of these years, I don't genuinely remember why that ended up being the way in which I thought was the right way to progress.
Well, I think two things that if I remember, one is that, both of us were linked to the Belmont report in important ways. For me, it was starting in my childhood. My dad watched the hearings. He was in public health, so he was very interested. So I had that kind of as the background music of my childhood is the Belmont report. And also because Dr. Israel Goldiamond was a member of that panel, which I'll never forget the day. You know, there's the Belmont report, which you can get online, which is like a little pamphlet. Dear Malaika went to our library, went through stacks and archives, came out with stacks of the whole Belmont report. And she brought them to my office. And I'm like, whoa. I mean, there were books everywhere and stacks everywhere going through the whole thing. And part of, I think, our fascination was the fact that Goldiamond had been part of that really historic process. So I think the Belmont report, and then also I was a young assistant professor when Steve Fawcett wrote the paper on community action research. And I remember literally when it came out thinking, oh my gosh, this is really important. And I think, you know, it was probably a little bit later that Malaika came as a student. And of course that article went into every class I was teaching because there was always a way for it to be important. So I think the Belmont report and that Fawcett article were really, and of course Wolf 78, like that was also kind of underneath the Fawcett article or supporting it. But I think those things started us looking down the path, and then also being interested in reflective practices as individuals and as a discipline. So I think that was some of the evolution, but also to understand kind of the way our labs had worked at UNT was that we always had multiple things running. So at the same time that like I was doing all this, she was doing like three other projects and other research, and things kind of morph. And if you could see my hands, dear listener, you would see they're going all over the place. But that, you know, another person could be working on, for example, how do you get people to have more progressive skilled discussions with one another? That's being discussed in the lab while Malaika is looking at the data in Java. And, you know, another student might be looking at how can Latino families get access to services, and then how can the services be more responsive to the cultural fit, et cetera, et cetera. So it's hard to pin that down, but anyway.
Sure. Yeah, well, and you guys sort of, your answer somewhat led to another important sort of point in this conversation, which is ultimately what this paper focuses on, which is a review you did of papers published in the Journal of Applied Behavior Analysis within the first 50 years that you sort of coded and analyzed as the content of those papers related to, I think, as you described, sort of the spirit of the Bearwolf and Risley Seven Dimensions published in 68, the ethics principles outlined in the Belmont Report, and the practices described in that Fawcett 91 paper that you referenced. Can you talk about ultimately what were some of the variables? A lot of variables, so I don't necessarily think we, you know, have time as much as I'd love to get into the nitty-gritties, but what were some of like the bigger components you were looking at as you started to review some of these papers published in Java?
I think one of the main components that became really, really important for us, and these conversations also were in our social justice lab at North Texas, and a lot of different student engagement and a lot of rigorous critique and question asking about what it meant to be an applied science and who the science is benefiting, who is usually going to be selected to participate in these types of experiments. And those conversations led specifically to the Belmont Report has respect for persons, beneficence, and justice as the three pillars for biomedical and behavioral research. And those three pillars really are the bare minimum with regard to biomedical and behavioral research, right? At minimum, people need to understand what they're walking into from a research participant perspective. They need to consent. There needs to be practices for assent. And then the beneficence piece, meaning that they need to benefit, which directly aligns with applied behavior analysis, right? There needs to be a benefit on the other end of the research engagement, and that benefit extends to the person immediately and then to society on the other end of that, so that science can continue to progress and so that people's lives can continue to improve and that research is not done in vain in no uncertain terms. And then justice was probably where we started engaging in a lot more interaction and a lot more conversation, because the justice piece with regards to the Belmont Report specifically talks about over-selecting vulnerable populations to participate in research. And there was a wonderful article that came out, I believe in 2010, that talked about the over-selection of homogeneous groups of people. And they said that most people that elect to participate in psychological or behavioral research, the participants are from WEIRD. They use an acronym, WEIRD demographics. So Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic groups of people are typically the ones that participate in these types of research questions, and in psychology in particular. So in applied behavior analysis, we started to realize and we started to reflect on the articles that we had read and thinking about the participants. Well, the participants are typically very vulnerable. They typically have some sort of disability. There's a long line of literature, of course, with challenging behaviors. There's lines of literatures with regard to people having intellectual and or developmental disabilities. And then layering on top of that, we thought, well, another what are these areas of vulnerabilities? Well, race and ethnicity is an area of vulnerability, potentially. You could also have areas of vulnerability that have to do with the person's occupation or their income level, and so on and so forth. And so I think we started with wondering, who are these participants, and what does our flagship journal offer us to know who these people are? And also, what's the identity of the researchers on the other end of that? And that started probably the most critical thought process for looking into these articles a little bit deeper and digging into the permanent products and trying to find out a little bit more about the context of the research engagement.
On one hand, there was not necessarily like a value about the research should be with these people and not with these people. I think it was more that in terms of like demographics, that it's kind of like when you go and collect, it is for us, this was like going in and collecting baseline. Like, what's the baseline? Who are we working with? What are we working about? What happens with them? How do we know it happens with them? So at a big kind of bird's eye level, I look at what is in the paper as a way of seeing at least along some dimensions, because there's a lot that we didn't also do. In fact, I often wish that the Schwartz and Kelly paper on quality of life had been published before we did this, because she's beautiful. Beautiful, like delineations of areas that would indicate quality of life changes. But I think between the Belmont, between Fawcett, and looking at what's going on in terms globally, in terms of what's going on in like I said, vulnerability and inequities, I think we tried to develop sets of measures that it would at least give us some baseline about that. And I think that, as Malaika said, you know, the findings, like if you look at the graphs, it's a little disappointing, because in some areas, when the journal started out, and in fact, that's what Wolf talks about in the 78 article, is social validity and social significance are hard. They're not scientifically impossible, but they're scientifically very difficult to understand what is valued, and when there are conflicting values between different groups, but also to understand the things that are most important to humans. And I think he even talks about, you know, like love. How do you understand all those things that are so socially important to humans from a scientific lens? And so part of the discussions in our social justice lab and in all of Malaika's advising meetings and over coffee were all about what would be the baseline measures that we need to understand where we are on some of those dimensions. So then when we looked at it, you can see at the inception of our field, some things were pretty close. Like there was a lot more social validity. There appeared to be more in the natural environment where you would see substantive life changes. But then that seems to wane over time, at least according to most of the graphs. And then also looking at things like, for example, looking at things like voluntariness, which is part of the Belmont, you know, it's not always clear, was there consent and assent? And part of that, we talk about this, is maybe people just aren't saying what they did because it wasn't as important to enunciate that. However, I think because of the times we live in, and what we talked about is it is now. Because number one, we have both our internal and our external communications to think about, how people look at us as a field. Number two, new researchers coming in don't always know, oh yeah, that's taken for granted. And that needs to be communicated, that there is an explicit valuing of this person's degree of voluntariness and desire to participate this, and there needs to be explicit discussion about how this was fair and beneficial to the person to be involved. So some of it is probably there, but not articulated. And that is part of what our discussion was about, is that it's important for multiple reasons to be more explicit. I think that's happened also, for example, with compassionate and caring interventions. You know, when I started in the field, it would be horrifying, and my teachers would be horrified if we did something where, you know, the people we were working with were uncomfortable and not willing participants. But you know what? That wasn't talked about in the publications, but that was part of, you know, people being held down and screaming and all of that was not part of what we were doing. And we didn't say, oh, and we didn't hold people down while they were screaming, you know. But now we need to be explicit about that because of what people are learning, and the omissions may make it look like we're doing something we're not. And maybe some groups are, I don't know, but I think that was part of what happened and part of what we saw in the measures, is that for the most part, there aren't enough explicit measures or descriptions to let us know where our baselines are. For example, are there more children receiving behavior reduction programs who are, you know, Black and brown children? Or are there more children learning to label things that are not Black and brown? Like all those kinds of things. And this is where I think some of it gets complicated within a behavior analytic framework and in the discussions, is sometimes, and I was part of and understand this movement, is you never want people to have barriers because of the labels they hold. And you never want to say, oh, there's a correlation between, you know, Middle Eastern girls and this happening. That's not why we're saying to report the demographics. We're saying because you want full participation and opportunity of all people, not because you want to make correlational discussions about, you know, what Middle Eastern girls do or what Black boys do. That's not why we're saying for the demographics. And I think sometimes some of the discomfort with some behavior analysts is they think we're moving towards that kind of correlational way of looking at the world and grouping people by their identities in that way, and that's really not at all where we were going with it.
Yeah, that's really helpful context to sort of understanding how you were looking at that data, some of the findings. I really liked your point about the importance of explicitly outlining the procedures that we're using. And you know, I was thinking about, as you were talking about and sort of elaborating on the importance of that, that, you know, early in the field's history, yeah, it was obvious, or it was sort of trained in these labs or these groups to not do things like, you know, hold down clients who are crying and resisting for prolonged periods of time or whatever it might be. But as the field has grown, right, we have over 60,000 behavior analysts, board certified behavior analysts now. So many of those like unspoken, unwritten rules of what it means to provide high quality behavior analysis can get lost in the prolific dissemination of our field. And now we're adding so many people into the field at such high rates that you're losing some of those incredibly important sort of, And the way that I think about it is just like basic human service sort of skill sets necessary to provide high quality services. And so, yeah, I'm 100% with you that so much of this really needs to be completely laid out and explicitly outlined for everyone. Otherwise, it can get lost. You know, the importance of the details of all this, I think, is immense. I want to be respectful of both of your time. There's a large section of this paper that talks about different topics of consideration on this overall topic, where you talk about commodification and taking data and colonial relationships and all these sort of really rich topics of interest and importance. We're going to, you know, probably not have time to dive into all of them in the way that I would like to. So can I kick things over to the two of you to say, like, are there one or two or a couple of these topics that you would like to sort of amplify and highlight here? And then obviously for the listeners who want to learn more about this, of course, check out the paper and dive deeper into all of them. But can you give us just a little sample of some of these considerations?
Yeah, I will say that the considerations, it's really interesting to read. The paper now has been published for 2 years, which is really mind-blowing to think about, but to reflect on, well, to reflect a little bit further back. So around 2018, these ideas started percolating and we started to understand really like, hey, this is what we're going to look into. We're going to do a content review of the Journal of Applied Behavior Analysis. Times are shifting. We're trying to figure things out. We're in our social justice lab and we're laboring and we're asking really difficult questions. And then it really felt like the world turned on its axis with the very, very, very difficult murder of Mr. Floyd, and then and several other people of color, and that being part of a global pandemic where we all had to really shift our priorities and our lives and our expectations about what it meant to stay healthy as individuals and as groups, we never anticipated the world would be in upheaval at the same time that we're laboring in this area of research. And so 2 years later after publication and the semester that I defended my dissertation, I went home for spring break and was never allowed to return to campus. This is a huge loss, right? This is a huge grieving process that I didn't realize was a grieving process until I was on the other end of it. We'd been working together, Shal and I'd been together day after day, hour after hour, sometimes into wee hours of the morning, getting these things together. And then the world turned on its axis and we didn't know which way was up. And we heard about this new platform called Zoom, and I defended my dissertation on Zoom, which was very interesting. And so to go back and read the end of the paper in preparation for talking to you today was nostalgic in one way, but then also the urgency hasn't disappeared. I'm actually more concerned about making sure that people, especially behavior analysts, if we're just going to talk amongst each other, especially behavior analysts, I'm very passionate about behavior analysts understanding that science doesn't work in a binary and discovery doesn't work in a binary and quality of life is not a binary and improvement is not a binary and nobody's right. And it's weighing on me pretty heavily as I go into this next phase of my life and my career, because we talk about third ways at the end of the manuscript, because we're tired of people in the field, especially begging us for checklists and telling us, okay, what do we do next? Okay, give me a prescription. And science is not prescriptive. And people's lives are not to be put in 2D on a checklist and whether or not things got better. And social validity measures are not a survey at the end of a research project to say, hey, do you like that or not? And so my passion and my hope is that these third ways of understanding things means that people come from varying backgrounds, varying perspectives, but there's a commonality in the sense that there's an important problem to be solved and that nobody wins this problem-solving game. It's not a game. These are people's lives, but that you can do things under tension that are still meaningful, but they're still collaborative. And that's one of the main things that I would really like for progress to be made in the science, amongst scientists in particular.
I love that. And I especially love that sort of third ways approach that you described, and really getting into the nuance that the reality that it's not as simple as, oh, did you do this one thing? Okay, cool. You met sort of all DEI and assent and consent and all standards because you did that one thing and you're good to go on that. It is something that has to be embedded and considered and adapted in so many parts of treatment and approach and all of those things that I find a very similar pressure from the work I do on assent to, can you give us a checklist of five things that solves assent and client involvement and treatment decisions. And I don't have faith that that is really possible. And I think it sort of misses the larger picture, which is it should be, I think, incorporated and informing the way that we ultimately approach our clients and sort of every aspect of treatment. Shala, do you have any other highlights or anything to add to some of the big topics of consideration here?
You know, I will say, like Malika, I went back and reread the paper this morning. And I look back on some things I've published and I think, oh, I don't want to look at that again. And I look back on some things and think, oh, this is really good. I still feel strongly, or, you know, that was a good analysis of the data, whatever it is. I look back at this and I feel the same way as Malika. I feel there's an urgency. I feel like the pandemic, it was a stimulus disruptor. And what happened, what was made visible, because as you all know, what happened to Mr. Floyd has been happening to many people for a very long time in different ways, many men, women across the globe, and is still happening in horrific ways. There are still children in cages at the border. You know, this is all still happening. But I think the visibility of it, the stimulus disruption in combination with the aversiveness of it all, created an opening. And Roy talks about it as a portal. There was this opening created for behavior change. And you see that in our discipline. You know, a lot of things that have been starting work or laboring, like you look at the people with behavior and social issues, you know, decades of working in these arenas. But all of that disruption and aversive stimulation made an opening for people to shift a little bit the way they were looking at things. And I think, I don't even really know for post-pandemic, I'm not really sure what we are, but I think there's a sense now of not wanting to think about it and not for the people of privilege, not wanting to see the injustice and to move beyond it. But I think that the urgency is still there. And my guess is, as a species, we will continue to have disruptions until we figure out how to work it out. And I think that our science is part of working it out. And that's the beauty of it. I do think Malika brought up the third ways. And I think, and you actually brought up the dialogue. I think there were three very powerful interrelated things we talked about at the end. One is that the necessity of having these conversations, the necessity of collecting the data, of looking at the data from multiple vantage points, but also the necessity of having discussions about what our values are. You know, what are our core values in terms of what we're doing with our research methodology, our publications, our outcomes, and how do we revisit those and make sure that our actions, our behavior is aligned with those values as a discipline and as individuals? And nobody has any answers. Again, the beauty of science is the discovery of it. But without the dialogue and the value and perspective part of that, it's going to be very hard to find solutions in third ways that are beneficial to the whole system of the planet. And, you know, we look at ecology and what's happening with the environment. It's the same thing. You can't just like see, you know, how do we make the water better in Denton? That's not going to affect the whole ecosystem of our globe. And we humans are like that too. So, which again goes back to Dr. Lutzker and really that basis about eco-behavioral approaches, that it's the system and the individual behaviors within that system. I do want to give a shout out to Dr. Tracy Sheehan, who was also an author on this, an advisor for Malaika's work, who really is one of the most well-versed people in systems analysis and cultural behavior analysis, who really, I think, was also part of the discussions influencing it. And Dr. Alicia Recruz, who is a cultural anthropologist, and her work has focused on understanding what happens across systems and borders, in particular to young children and families, and about participatory research. So I think those last three sections of the article are heavily influenced by each of the four of us, our different positionalities, and then really beautiful Malaika being the nexus for articulating a way forward. And I think it is I look back on it, I think, oh, that's a good way forward. Good job, Malaika.
Yeah. And it was a fascinating paper, and there's just so much good information in it. We really can't do it justice in an hour long conversation, unfortunately. But I do recommend that the listeners go to the paper, check it out, get all those details from the paper. For people who are interested in this topic and learning more about it, obviously they should check out the paper. Are there any other resources, recommendations, anything that you might have? And of course, we'll link to all of this in the show notes, but anything else that someone who's interested in this topic could really sink their teeth into?
I want to add something, because this was important, and it was important in a paper that Miller, Recruz, and I wrote many years ago, is that we have got to be open to the labor and the fruits of other disciplines. I know during this process, Malaika and I both were heavily influenced, and we have a whole lot of fangirl going on about the work of Ruha Benjamin at Princeton and Leili Maparayan at Wesley, that they are both doing phenomenal work, one in artificial intelligence and how to move forward and reduce racism as much as possible, and the other one in the area of womanism. You know, their work is incredible. And those are only two people. But I do think that's really important, is that we're looking at the work of other people who are coming at it from different angles. And we cite their work as well as others, and we've given you a bunch of articles and links you can look at. So,
yeah, I can't express enough how important it is for people that are interested in solving big problems to utilize the wisdom from other disciplines and to digest lots of information, especially for graduate students, right? It's really, really important that Shala and I are constantly getting information from astrophysics, from sociology, from random movies that our children recommend for us. We were watching a Disney movie with Shala's granddaughter a couple months ago, and we're having these deep philosophical conversations about red pandas. What was the name of that movie? It was so good.
I can't remember, but and Uber drivers.
Like and Uber drivers.
I had this discussion with an Uber driver. He was brilliant. He's also a filmmaker, but he was really interested in how the idea we just take for granted manifest destiny. Well, that's a really messed up idea when you think about it. And that sort of led to bridging about the work of Quijano on colonialism. So like, there are people thinking everywhere and linking everywhere, and there's so much to learn.
Yeah, it's called Turning Red. It's a Disney movie. Red, it's great. Yeah. And then, of course, the story, I think, and the importance of people's stories, the importance of their lived context and their lived existence and where they came from and their family and where their next generations land and are going to. And the story of Henrietta Lacks was one of the most pivotal stories in my framing and understanding of what it meant. Number one, also as a Black woman, and also having Black women in my family who've talked to me about what it was like growing up in the South and what it was like to have opportunities that were not afforded to them and the things they had to do just to get in positions so that I could be sitting here today doing this podcast, right? So these things are not taken for granted. And stories like The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks were, again, a wonderful story that Shala introduced me to. It became a movie also. I think Oprah was part of making sure that that went to film and in motion picture. But then also thinking about the fact that, again, as we're doing this dreaming and as we're thinking about Henrietta Lacks and the men in Tuskegee who unfairly were put towards all kinds of experimentation regarding syphilis that they were completely unaware of, and the goal at the other end of that research endeavor was for them to die so that their bodies could be looked into and the effects of syphilis to be looked into after they died. And so for all of those conversations to be had, and then the pandemic to hit, and then the search for a vaccine, and guess who shows up on the scene again at the front run is Henrietta Lacks and her cells that are immortal, because those cells are going to be the way that we figure out a way to keep people from being sick and contracting this horrible virus and having their health impacted. So these stories don't stop telling this, these stories don't stop being relevant. They just end up popping up in different ways of being relevant. And so that is one thing that Shal and I are constantly doing. I mean, you see the bookshelves, the listeners can't see our bookshelves behind us, but we're constantly looking at other disciplines to try and inform science and help us understand the bigger why, the meta why of why we do the things we do.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think, you know, behavior analysis does not have a monopoly on science. There's plenty of other good science happening around us, and to tap into that, right, and to be aware of that and to allow that to inform our practices and our approaches, I think is very wise. So I appreciate you sharing that and sharing your wisdom, both within the paper and on the podcast today. Again, I wish I had 3 more hours with you both to continue talking about that, but we are at time. So thank you both so much for coming on today. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Please remember to subscribe and like us on whatever podcast player you use, and to find us and follow us on social media to stay up to date on our latest episodes. I'd like to thank a few people for helping create this podcast. I'd like to thank Stephanie Peterson, the editor of the journal Behavior Analysis and Practice. I'd like to thank ABAI for sponsoring this podcast. And I'd like to thank my assistant producers, Jesse Perrin and Hannah Gray, for their assistance in this episode. Finally, I'd like to thank Jim Carr and his band New Latitude for letting us sample their song Cruising Altitude throughout this podcast.